Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so welcome back. I've just noticed we quietly celebrated our 300th episode last week, which I haven't even noticed until I've published it. So congrats to us, and thank you all for consistently supporting us and helping us expand our reach in the last 7 years or so since this podcast started. And we really appreciate it. Subscriber numbers are always increasing. Reviews are always super positive. And people keep mentioning the podcast and the value it brings to them whenever they contact us. So we're well and truly grateful for your loyalty. This kind of love that you're showing us is very literally what gets us out of bed in the morning. So again, thank you. Also, heads up, I'll be away for a month on an annual holiday from tomorrow. I call this a holiday, but of course, there's no such thing when you're running a small business. I'll still be working for at least half of every day while away, but not sure how many episodes I'll be able to publish during this period. So apologies in advance if frequency drops or stops completely until mid-July or so. I promise to be back with a vengeance immediately upon my return. Okay, so for today's episode, this is another one which I've chosen to publish shortly after recording and out of the order of the current backlog of episodes that are waiting to be published. And that's because it's a current affairs and news related one. So a resident macroeconomic expert, former Financial Times and now independent freelance economic research analyst, Daniel Gallucci, is finally back with us. I say a resident, but this is after several years of hiatus as he was moving from Thailand to Japan, got married, had a first child, and was generally super busy with, well, life really. But in any case, he's now back. Which we're thrilled with. And as always, we talk Japan and other Asian economies, and this time we have a good few years to catch up on. So we cover a bunch of topics. First and foremost, what things looked like during and post-pandemic in Japan and elsewhere, the effects of both the Federal Reserve and the Bank of Japan, the USA and Japan central banks, on supply, demand, equity markets, property markets, the low US dollar to Japanese yen exchange rates, what this does to government bonds, corporate bonds, and what the low rates are doing to the economy here overall, GDP growth, the coming US elections, tensions related to China and its overtake of Hong Kong, as well as current rhetoric regarding Taiwan, the utilization of women and immigrants in Japan's workforce, investment strategies, and so much more. So really super packed, super educational conversation. Grab yourselves a coffee or a drink, whatever you're into and whatever time of day you happen to be tuning in at, and enjoy the chat. I will see you again on the other side. All right, Dan, welcome back.
Thanks, good to be back.
I've browsed through our previous conversations and it looks like we haven't had one since 2020, I think. So welcome back to the Japan Real Estate Podcast.
2020, well, nothing much has happened
in
the world since then.
So I think last time we were talking about, that was mid-COVID when we spoke. It was like later in the year in 2020 when it was very clear that there's an actual pandemic going on. Mm-hmm. And I know from a property market perspective, it hasn't done that much. Like there hasn't been a crash or prices plummeting or, I mean, vacancies took a bit longer to fill in, but not much else. And some outskirts like Fukuoka City, for example, was still going up
slightly even throughout the pandemic. And as soon as that's ended, everything started on an upper heading trajectory again. Is that reflective of what happened macroeconomics wise in Japan?
I suppose so. I mean, the economy as a whole has been pretty steady throughout. You probably see more swings in something like property with its assets, and there's a global influence, I mean, an international influence with buyers coming in, and then the yen, of course, playing a big role, and maybe we can riff on that a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, the economy here has been stable, much more so than almost anywhere else. But that's, I mean, that's Japan's double-edged sword all the time, right? Which is that it's stable, but there's little or no growth.
Yeah.
And what little COVID stimulus happened here and everything in that direction.
COVID stimulus was very generous here, actually, compared to other countries.
Oh, to a lot of them, right.
Yeah.
That clearly helped, but it didn't have the kind of massive impact that, like, I think you saw in the U.S. with, you know, suddenly people who are living paycheck to paycheck are feeling a little bit more flush and just putting more money into the economy, and
yeah.
Things are always kind of flat here, which is not to say uninteresting, but
yeah.
I think not really all that much happened when you zoom out and look at the trends, although, you know, month to month, year to year, seemed like it.
I think Japan has this global image of a safe haven as well, right? So actually when crisis does hit, whether it's the pandemic and later the Ukraine war and now the Gaza war, whatever the case may be,
yeah.
People actually flock to the yen, right?
Generally, that's been true. But things have changed the last, year plus, 2.5 years, 2 years, because of the U.S., so everything has changed because of the U.S., because of the Fed, right? If you have yen assets and you're not happy about that, just blame the Fed.
Right.
It's as simple as that, basically. Historically, so there was a little bit of a blip. For example, in, 2013, there was this little taper tantrum thing. It's been a while. I think it's 2013. And you saw risk assets or risk on investors kind of take money out of emerging markets, and then they like the dollar, they like the euro, they like the yen, and that sort of general dynamic I think still is true. But the thing is the interest rates and the Fed, right? So again, like, blame the Fed. So you have an almost zero interest rate in Japan. The Bank of Japan announced the end of negative interest rates recently.
I haven't seen much happening since then.
And then raised the rate by 10 basis points.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, it's something. It's more about the signals that they're sending. But the rate is really high in the U.S. And these are both considered like highest class, most riskless of the riskless government bond assets. Well, what are you going to pick as a bank, as an investor, as a fund? If you need to hold bonds, it's in your mandate, or it's in your how you mix your portfolio, you're going to buy the U.S. bonds that are paying like 3-5%.
Yeah,
not the Japanese bonds paying unless that's part of your play, and you know, somewhere somehow it is. It's not like nobody's buying these things, but
if you want to diversify to Asian markets, I suppose there are higher yielding options to diversify into, right?
Right, in different classes, and you can make more in other places than in the U.S. I mean, if we're talking about government bonds or very high grade corporate bonds, but then you know, you got more risk, and that's the trade off. But U.S. government bonds and JGBs are in the same class, so like there's really no reason to buy JGBs unless you have some kind of complex currency play going on, or hedging play, or, you know, again, a certain amount of it, sure, but that's a big driver of it, I think.
Yeah.
That's the biggest thing. There's just the competition between the two is direct, so there's just nobody looking at that, and that drives the yen down.
Right.
And I think what's maybe interesting...
So was that a major factor, you think, in the yen dropping as far as it did?
Yeah.
Okay.
The overwhelming explanation.
Yeah. Right.
Not the Japanese economy. Nothing's really changed there.
Okay.
And not really the U.S. economy per se, although that's a factor too. I think what's something to back up as a point of interest, and this is all sort of 101, and I'm coming at it from a, you know, I'm a I'm an observer. I've been around this stuff for a while, but I'm not deep into this as my forte. But you know, it's maybe useful background for listeners that aren't into the space or haven't, you know, looked into these questions much, which is how inflation and how interest rates and how the economic outlook kind of drive bond, or let's say current, let's go with currency to
keep, yes, please,
keep it simpler, prices. And there's one thing that I found confusing or unintuitive when I studied this. Most of my experience here is coming in through master's degree study and a bit of job market dabbling. On the face of it, all right, if you have country A and country B, and inflation is high in country A and low in country B, and they're both selling, let's take the bonds out of it. Let's just stick with the currency. All else being equal, you would expect, so let's do Japan and US to keep it simple. Let's imagine the US during high inflation. Okay, so high inflation US and a zero or low inflation in Japan. All else being equal, you would expect that to drive the yen up, meaning more appreciate and drive the dollar down relative to the yen, because inflation is going to weaken the value of the currency. Right, that's intuitive, and that sort of makes sense if you reduce it to equations and there's no other factors involved. But the thing is, that ignores a lot of market psychology and everything about future outlook. So although that means that, yes, like if you took the same amount of dollars and yen today, and then you just froze the global economy and you froze everything except inflation kept ticking, that the yen asset should be in a better place than the dollar asset down the road. But dollars are linked to the U.S. economy, and the U.S. economy is growing. And probably more importantly, the U.S. economy is in high demand from a global investment perspective, which means people want dollars. So there's this basic market effect, supply and demand effect going on with dollars, that even though the inflation's high, people want them. So if people want them, that sort of overruns or over that trumps forget the capital T Trump, that trumps the impact of the inflation, which might be like you might look at it and say, well, but you know, we know the inflation, we know that the yen is holding its value better. Well, that doesn't matter if people want it. You know, you can kind of extend that to these crazes of buying up whatever collectibles or Bitcoin or things that, you know, you may or may not think that they have value. But if people think that they have value and they drive the value up, the value goes up.
But okay, so that explains the yen to US dollar ratio, but then why is the yen so much lower than other currencies now as well?
Well, I guess the yen has underperformed a lot of currencies, but they're all linked to the dollar. The dollar is the other side of the ratio in all these cases. So it's much more about that. But that's a good point. I don't have numbers in front of me, but if you look at emerging market currencies, some of them have outperformed the yen, especially when the yen's been at its worst in the last while, which is sort of surprising because those are typically higher risk, very much higher inflation places, you know, broadly speaking. Mm. But I guess you have the back to the competition explanation, the dollar and the yen and the US and Japan and US and Japanese government bonds, these things are all kind of in the same bucket,
but demand remains higher for the
assets. Whereas, let's say my favorite country, Thailand. You know, Thai government bond may not be particularly appealing, but it's in a totally different asset class than a Japanese government bond, and
there's a return there,
right. And the risk is higher, the return's different, everything's different. Yeah. So you're not comparing. You're never going to be in the position that you're comparing. You know, should I hold Thai government or U.S. government bonds, deciding how to weigh between Japanese government and U.S. government bonds or German bonds,
right?
Because they're all sort of in the same bucket, and that extends to the currencies, and that extends to what drives the demand or the investment going into the currencies and the economies broadly speaking, which are these are very different plays, I think. So if you have the baht has done better than the yen for a lot of this time. That's investment coming in. That's just totally different dynamics than what's happening in Japan. But it doesn't really mean that the the bot's a better thing to hold or anything like that. I'd rather have yen.
Yes.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in. Fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know. They're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own. But longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home, with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
Yeah. So how do you feel, especially now that you're living here as well, how do you feel all of this is factored into daily life for your average Japanese or average Japan resident? Like, I know I feel the yen, I feel the pain when I go out of the country, yeah. But living here, have you felt much has changed with the yen dropping as far as it did?
I don't think so. I don't think for most people they feel very much, unless they're, I mean, as consumers, if they're in some business that is dealing with trading or something, it must be a tremendous impact. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. And let's not forget that weak currencies can be great for countries.
For exports, for sure.
So,
right?
Yeah. So you know, that's a big part of the explanation too as to why the Bank of Japan or, you know, any given central bank might be quite okay with the weak currency. Besides the fact that they probably can't do very much about it, but you know, they might also be happy about it. So I think for the average person, and this is just observational, yeah, as you said, living here, doesn't seem like much. You know, I live with my wife's family. They complain about higher prices, but that's more of an inflation thing than a yen thing.
Yeah.
For the most part. But I will say, we're looking at going to the US, and the looks on my mother-in-law and her friends are going, the looks on their faces, the prices that I'm talking about are just, you know, their jaws just drop. And I'm like, I'm pushing, I found a good deal on a hotel. We're going to stay in New York for a little while. In the city, and you know, I'm looking at what I know is a good deal, but their jaws are on the floor, and like the conversation just stops, and then go back to a few weeks later, and you know, the deal's gone.
I just booked one in Osaka for less than $40 a night, which is amazing.
Yeah,
it still is the case.
You could have been a park bench in Central Park for $40 a night.
So, how do you feel? Okay, so Japan's economy overall, through the pandemic, through the Ukraine war and what's happening now, which probably didn't have as much of an effect as Japan, as the pandemic did. Property prices have held, now rising, even in rural prefectures, which is rare. Even salaries have started going up, not significantly, but a lot more than they have in previous years.
Yeah.
How are things with the rest of the countries that you normally deal in, Southeast Asian country economies, how have they weathered through and then emerged from the pandemic economically?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think just to hang on Japan for a second, it is interesting. I mean, Japan is always going slow and making everything is slow. Decisions are slow, action is slow, economic changes are slow. But this is all interesting that, you know, wages are bumping up a little bit. The Bank of Japan is trying to create or maintain or drive some inflation. This is all pretty interesting, actually. And not to go in another direction.
Immigration gates are inching open a little bit.
centimetering, yes, maybe. But still, I mean, it's interesting by Japan standards and stuff.
Yeah.
And neighboring here, and I know in a market that you like for property, again, not to change the subject, but I think what's happening in Kumamoto with TSMC is really fascinating.
Yeah. So that's, they just announced a second plant, I think, right?
Yeah. I don't remember when or if it's certain or just a plan, but so this is the Taiwan semiconductor company, right? The world's most important semiconductor manufacturer, and they're setting up, or they have set up, in neighboring Kumamoto. And that's really fascinating, that Japan has become more attractive for this kind of a play for a whole variety of reasons, a lot of which is not economic. It's security based and a lot of other things, but that's
true. I think stable infrastructure and power provision has a lot to do with it. You can't get that kind of services in other countries in Asia, right?
Yeah. But nonetheless, very interesting.
So
there are economic changes afoot here. They're just slower and sometimes harder to see in a noisy world, but they're interesting and noteworthy. So if we look at Southeast Asia, I lived for a long time in Thailand. And the easy go-to story there for me is always Thailand, the underperformer, Thailand, the disappointment in the scope or, you know, it, among its peers, not only in Southeast Asia, but other emerging markets. And unfortunately, that remains the case. Thailand has hardly grown by any emerging market standards in the last 10 years, or God, no, much more than that now. Mm-hmm. I used to say the last decade, but it's closer to two. Now it has grown, and if you go there as a tourist and you see the glimmery skyscrapers in Bangkok, you'll think that a lot more is going on than is. But the growth there has been really slow, to the tune of 2-3% a year, among countries where 4-5-6 sometimes 7% is normal.
When you say among countries, you mean other Southeast Asian countries or
other sort of well performing. Emerging markets, China, India. What little preparation I did, I pulled some numbers here for the interview. So if we take Vietnam and Thailand, and Vietnam's story is the opposite to that over the last decade or so, that it's come out of, it's really like come out and overperformed in terms of the overall economic growth. And this is equally interesting as Thailand's failure to capitalize on its previous momentum. So if we go back to, so we start with 2013, and we look at the next 10, I guess that's 11 years. We look at the next 11 years through 2023, counting the two end years. Thailand ends up growing a whopping 17%.
Yeah.
Totally. And Vietnam is 70.
Really?
Yeah. And those both include big dips during COVID.
Yeah.
Because Thailand is doing, year after year, is doing like 3%, 3%, 4%, 4%, 2%, and then COVID, negative 6, and then post-COVID. Oh, post-COVID.
It's still better than Japan, though.
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, Japan is way ahead and also very slow. But we're, you know, when they're coming from a low base, they should be doing better than this.
Yeah.
But let's just do post-COVID. So 2021, the Thai economy rebounded a whopping 1.5%. Vietnam was 2.6. Indonesia was 3.7. The Philippines is kind of a weird case because it dropped so much during COVID, but it was up 5.7%. in 2021, and the list goes on. And then 2022, a little bit of a more normal year. Thailand was again 2.6%, whereas the others, Vietnam was back and it was at 8%. Indonesia was 5.3%. Philippines was 7.6%.
That's interesting. Do you lump Thailand in the emerging economies bucket? Because I had the feeling that it was out there for a while now. Like when I'm thinking Philippines, Vietnam, I'm not thinking Thailand in the same boat.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's further along, but yeah.
Okay.
Still the emerging market. Malaysia is further along. It's a middle income country, but it's still, we are generally comparable for a lot of reasons as well. Being in the region and having a lot of the same manufacturing appeal. But that's expected to be a bit slower because it is quite a lot more developed. But let's go to dollars. This is interesting too. So in 2014, just the numbers that I have in front of me, Vietnam's GDP was only a little bit more than half that of Thailand. So Vietnam's was 233 billion and Thailand's was 407 billion in 2014. Go to 2023 or 2022. I don't have the dollars for 2023. I can do it. Well, let's just round it off. So Thailand's last year was a little bit over 500 billion, and Vietnam's is also over 400 billion.
Oh wow! Okay.
So it's caught up a great deal, and at these paces of growth, the Vietnamese economy will be bigger than the Thai economy in less than 10 years easily, if nothing changes. And some things could change, and it's not to say that that's a bad thing. I mean, it's great for Vietnam. It's not great for Thailand by comparison. I think a lot of opportunity has been missed there.
But you're saying that's been the story for a while.
Yeah.
Now, if you've been following this podcast for a while, and in particular our JREP sessions, you're probably more than familiar with Blanca Kobayashi of Arc Reform. They're a bilingual renovation company serving clients in the Kanagawa and Kanto area, so Tokyo, Chiba, Saitama, Kawasaki, Yokohama. They can handle simple, small-scale projects as well as full house renovations, and they will work with you on the perfect design for your dream family home. But not only homes, Arc Reform also handle commercial property renovations, offices, restaurants, bars, shops, you name it, from traditional classics to the latest trends in interior design and renovations. So you want to email them for a free consultation and quote at info@arcreform.com. That's ARK reform, all one word, .com, and give your home or commercial space the love and care that it deserves.
How does the China story play into these economies, like the first the tensions, then the takeover of Hong Kong, now the tensions with Taiwan, and the generally like setting of footprints in various ocean sectors and countries in the area? Does that affect these? Obviously, it affects the countries that they're directly in conflict with, but does it affect any others?
Yeah. Let's divide the security and the geopolitical from the economic.
Mm.
The security implications are massive, but sort of out of the scope of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Except to the extent that they inform decisions about where to invest and where to make stuff.
National budgets and stuff. Okay.
Well, as well, but for global manufacturers, let's say. So one important thing we've seen is supply chain shifts out of China and into Southeast Asia. So this has been to the benefit of Southeast Asia, as well as India and some other places, Mexico. But speaking of Southeast Asia, like tons of companies have set up in Vietnam, have left, not necessarily exited all of China, but they've stopped new investments in China, or they've downscaled in China, and Vietnam has been their replacement. And it's not always framed that way in what companies say that they're doing, but you can just look at the pattern that, you know, this company's next new big plant isn't in China, it's in Vietnam.
Is anyone, any companies or any countries avoiding previous business investments or manufacturing in Taiwan for fear of a potential actual physical conflict at some point?
I think not. I don't think we've seen significant exiting, but we've seen choices to take the next steps elsewhere, like with TSMC.
Yeah.
TSMC is just way too big anyway for only operating in Taiwan, but there's a huge push from the US. There's the US CHIPS Act, it's an acronym. What does it stand for? The I forget
now. To avoid Chinese manufactured chips in US devices.
It's essentially subsidies and programs to encourage chip manufacturing in the US and in allied countries. I think it's not limited to the US. So we see things like that going on. And so we see, I guess we see smart, large international corporations avoiding new investments in Taiwan, probably for this reason. Along with the related reasons of just general diversification of critical industries to sort of safe or friendly, I'm doing air quotes for anybody you know listening to this and not watching the video, but you know, safe or friendly countries.
So it's which are again Vietnam, India.
Well, I mean to varying extents. Japan's great, so I think Washington would love to see more of what's happening with TSMC, you know, being replicated with other key chip makers and other you know, important sensitive industries. But you know, in the US and in Europe for sure, Europe meaning EU, but then also like friendlier countries and just other different countries. So Vietnam, sure, Thailand, anywhere that's different and that isn't in China's pockets.
Yeah.
So you won't see the next, even if they give the land away, you won't see the next like big Intel plant in Cambodia or something, or Laos or Myanmar. I mean, these countries also can't really support it with infrastructure, but even if they could, they're so closely linked to China and so much under Chinese influence that just wouldn't happen. But relatively Western friendly places or neutral places like Thailand, Singapore too, that often gets left out because it's expensive and it's a totally different type of market and production base than the Southeast Asian countries we keep mentioning. But Singapore, and the ones we've said already, Vietnam, etc., seen as being, you know, relatively more friendly toward the U.S. and also just diversification, right? spreading the eggs out.
On a white collar perspective, is it true to assume that Singapore absorbed a lot of the exodus of financial services and stuff from Hong Kong when China took over?
Yeah. I have not looked at this, but I mean, as a general take, yes, definitely. Yeah. I hear that from contacts, and I think that's a given for sure.
Yeah.
I don't have numbers on it or anything like that.
Japan was vying for that. Like, Tokyo is going to be the next financial capital, now, but I don't think... Talk about infrastructures. Like, the physical infrastructures are in place, but the cultural infrastructures are nowhere near.
Yeah, the soft infrastructure, if we want to call it that.
Yeah.
And the bureaucratic side, you know, make it really hard.
This is not an easy place to do international business in.
Not to do it quickly anyway,
yeah.
Which is that's a big missed opportunity. That's a shame.
Yeah.
That's definitely a shame.
Yeah, it put it up there with the complete lack of utilization of women in the workforce and international, the potential is here, but no one's taking it up.
Yeah. Which I guess keeps it interesting for people like us and you know, creates smaller opportunities.
Oh, I'm not complaining. I just said the exact same thing in a conversation about women too. Like, please don't hire them. We'll keep hiring them ourselves. That's not a problem.
No, I thought you were going somewhere else with that. Yeah.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Not for a few years. No. Okay. Yeah. So, looking forward. No. We take all jokes here on the podcast. Looking forward, we haven't even talked about, actually before we move forward, let's do talk about how has the Ukrainian war and specifically the disruption of supply chains affected economies here?
Not something I'm very close to, but it's fed through into inflation. Ukraine is a huge grain producer, so that has knock-on effects for a lot of food prices. But I don't know how far it goes besides that, really.
Okay. So not a huge impact as far as you can tell?
No.
Not on a macroeconomic scale anyway?
No.
Okay.
I mean, outside of that area, and the Ukraine war has in some way impacted global fuel supplies and prices, but I'm not the guy to ask for that. But I think basically it's just been a modest, broad-based inflationary driver, but nothing massive.
Okay. Okay, so yes, moving forward, what are you seeing, trends, global events coming up or that just recently happened? Anything that you see shaping the next year or two as far as the economies in this region are, specifically Japan, but anywhere else as well?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, and none of this is coming from a point of pride as an American, but we just have to watch the US, basically. We have to keep watching the Fed that drives so much of what happens, and not just asset prices. It impacts inflation, it impacts global growth. It's the biggest thing to watch, along with, unfortunately, the US election. Because if Trump wins and creates various types of chaos, then that will reverberate around the world, I think. Not to say that I'm a big Biden fan or something, but the outlook is clearer with Biden. And in general, investors like clarity and stability. Although I'm sure some not small subset of investors would be happy to see Trump because they think he's going to be more pro-business and reduce taxes, and those things may be true, but probably don't have a lot of international impact. Those elements, whereas Trump's international meddling and unpredictability would.
Does that play into Fed decisions once the government, for example, changes? How do you see that, or does something else have to happen first for them to react?
It shouldn't, unless Trump somehow undermines like the Fed's independence or something. The central bank should be acting independently, and only in pursuit of its mandates on inflation and employment. So that's the U.S. has a dual mandate to target or to promote low unemployment and stable inflation. Some countries is only an inflation mandate or some other mandate, but that's how the Fed operates.
Okay, so putting the elections aside, what do you not predict, but what are you guessing the Fed might do in coming months?
I think if there's no global, sort of existential global, some kind of event that drives more inflation, what could that be? That could be an oil embargo or something like this. But if there's no surge in inflation or inflationary drivers, I think you're going to see the Fed slowly ramp down the interest rate.
Okay.
I'm a little bit of a bear or a skeptic in the sense that I think that the U.S. at least the equities markets will drop hard at some point, but that's more coming from it's hard for me to believe how high they've gone and that's not a bubble, but that's more just a personal gut instinct than some sort of a heavily researched one or something. But if the markets tank, like something tips off a housing market crash again or stock market crash, the Fed's behavior will be very different than if that doesn't happen. If that does happen, the Fed will very quickly cut interest rates hard because they'll want to support the economy and stop the bleeding, basically.
Okay.
But if that doesn't happen, then you want to just keep watching inflation. If inflation somehow, we're in unprecedented times with unprecedented trend, really. A lot of what we've seen since COVID is there's no precedent for it. So I think it is possible that inflation keeps going up and that the Fed actually holds or even increases rates. Like, who's to say? But my guess is that doesn't happen. They hold and gradually step it down.
So assuming a stable or slightly dropping interest rate scenario in the US, how does that again tie back into what's happening here? What will that result in our local economies here, do you think?
All else being equal, that should drive the yen back up.
Okay.
Because if rates on bonds are dropping, they're less appealing, and that the gap, the U.S. government bonds will still be more appealing than JGBs, but that gap will close, and so funds on the edges, funds will tip more toward
higher yield.
Towards the Japanese bonds than currently.
Yeah.
Because the gap is closing there. So, and then the demand for those will drive the yen.
What happens if there is a crisis there? Because I know from our experience back in 2011, like post global financial crisis, when the US crashed, we didn't have any US investors coming here because there were so many attractive deals in their backyard, right? Is that something that happens when there's a crash?
I would think, I would think so.
Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akiya Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily. Ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties, Akiya Mart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akiya Mart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akiya-mart.com. That's AKIYA-MART, akiya-mart.com, and kick off your search today.
Those with liquid funds are ready to pounce. Yeah. You might see, it's hard for people to come to Japan in this sense, but you might see probably an increase in more people like me who don't want to live in the US because it's so expensive. And that's not the only reason, but more retirement abroad and more nomading and all this kind of stuff, none of which has a huge economic impact.
Yeah, that's another two visas that Japan is not really picking up the slack on. There's so many better places in Asia to retire to and be a digital nomad in than Japan.
Yeah, the nomad visa is really silly.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the point was of that one.
Because it's only 6 months, that's the thing.
Yeah, it's like an extended tourist visa, but you have to prove so many things.
Yeah, and it's hard, but if it were 2 years, like, okay, like there would be some interest there, but
yeah.
You go through all these steps and then it's 6 months and you get 3 months anyway from most countries. So, I don't know, the crash. I think so. I mean, when asset prices drop but there will be knock on effects too. Depends what type of crisis. If it's stock markets, there's more connection. You could probably see.
Oh, but equity markets too, right? Like if the index falls off a cliff, then people start buying local stocks, right?
Right. But what I'm about to say is that the Japanese index will probably tank too.
Oh, okay. So it'll follow suit, you think?
Yeah.
Okay.
Whereas housing markets, not so much.
No, that's not going to
Not going to be connected. So it depends what assets, I suppose. But
yeah.
But yeah, I mean, if the U.S. kicks off, and we usually do it, the next crisis, and it's in equities, then the decline there should be more severe than it is in Japan or somewhere else. But you'll probably see general drop because everybody's pulling money out of risky things and putting them into safe things. And then perversely, that's sometimes good for the dollar. A crash in U.S. equities could be good for the dollar because everybody pulls out not only of U.S. So if you cash out of U.S. equities, you're back to dollars, dollar cash. But if you pull out of, if global funds pull out of, let's say, Japanese equities and other foreign equities, you're also oftentimes back to dollars.
So you're not going to stick with the yens for sure.
Right. So kind of perversely, the phenomenon is called flight to safety. And that's what you mentioned earlier. And that's been historically been good for the yen until now.
Yeah.
And what will happen there, it'll depend on, again, basically the Fed
Okay. Totally personal question now. You, with your wealth of knowledge and experience, what do you invest in?
I am just about real estate.
Just about real estate. Okay.
And I'm a long-term skeptic as well as a long-term non-saver when I was younger. Yeah. I have a pile of cash and I'm trying to buy something actively here in Japan.
Real estate.
Yeah, real estate.
Why real estate specifically? I didn't expect this answer. I mean, it's great for us, real estate podcast, but I didn't expect to hear that.
No, I didn't. Yeah. It's a variety of things. I don't like equities because I just think you have no control over things.
Yeah.
This is a personal bias. This is not investment advice. I'm also sort of bitter that I missed this big wave of run up in the last several years. So And who knows? Maybe it repeats, and Apple's and Google may all double again in the next 2 years. But I really don't think so. I think they're going to drop. I'm sort of a skeptic, and I don't want to come in now. And back to the yen for a moment. I'm earning dollars, and so I bought into yen a little early, but I've gotten hopefully good. I don't know. The yen goes to 200. I'm going to jump off a cliff. But
just look at the history. Yeah, don't try to guess the future. Yeah. It's as low as it's been for a long, long time.
Yeah, but I've come in. But I've gotten mostly into yen, and I'm just waiting to buy a property or a couple of properties, basically, for a variety of personal and kind of investment mindset reasons. Most of which is just that I do live here, and I want to establish like looking to the long term. What I hope to do is to start generating a teeny bit of property income, rental income, or Airbnb I'm interested in. And over time, you have that on record. I've formed a GK, that's the Japanese company structure
LLC.
That gets compared to an LLC. It's kind of different, but it's an easier to manage thing than the KK, which is the traditional corporation. Over time, that gets history, and then you can access financing. And so taking the long view, I'm more interested in income generation and getting access to Japanese financing, basically, because I do live here, and I don't have the kind of history or massive assets back home in the U.S. where I can easily just tap U.S. banks without...
And as you said, even if interest rates go high, it's still a joke compared to what they are in other parts of the world, right?
Yeah.
It is basically free money, or as close to free money as you can get.
Yeah. And the borrowing rates here are really low, and even if they go up a bit, they're still really low. So that's my play. It's a very personal outlook. Idiosyncratic.
So you're bearish on equity markets?
Yeah, now.
Yeah.
I think it's a bubble. Yeah.
But aren't you seeing any emerging trends? I mean, like a few years ago, we had cannabis. Now we have AI. The blockchain-based crypto, fintech. Nothing that you see emerging there?
Well, definitely. I mean, the winners of the, broadly speaking, AI and next-generation chip market will be... I mean, you probably can't go wrong buying TSMC and buying NVIDIA and Intel and AMD, etc. as a group, there'll be relative winners and losers among those. But it's going. But for me, it feels like a distraction to take my hard-earned, working man, salary man's savings and bother about that when I can just try to get a little bit of a gradual snowball going with property.
Absolutely. I've done that for years. I'm interested because I've only been doing that for over a decade now, so I actually want to be a bit more adventurous and start getting into
it. It's not a bad thing. If you're not in a hurry, I mean my very skeptical and not very academic viewpoint is simply to wait for the bubble if not to pop, then at least to deflate, and then buy your favorite tech stocks. But I don't like it now. They're just so expensive.
Yep.
And if nothing goes wrong in the world, but when has that been true for very long periods of time? Mm. And we are dealing with some really unusual and untested...
Yeah, frequency of crises is increasing
dynamics,
as well.
Between the Fed and the wars going on and Trump maybe coming back and AI and I don't know. But that mindset has kept me from you know, making some nice money these last few years. So,
well, real estate is safe and stable. I mean, that's usually why people get into it in the first place. Yeah. Something that you can, you know, touch with your hands, live in, if, you know, if the shit hits the fan, and, you know, yields are not going to take you through the roof, but you know what to expect, right? As close as you get to a monthly paycheck, I guess.
Yeah. And I think in combination with the fact that real estate remains one of the only ways for the average person to get investment financing.
Yes.
In this world.
Yeah.
Whether it's sort of a backdoor thing that it's a personal mortgage, but you grow out of it and you rent it out, or you buy a second one, and, you know, whatever, or it's an actual business loan. There's just so other few ways to tap that. So I think if you never, ever do that, you can probably get better returns in some other space than in real estate. But if you do that, then I think that the sky's the limit, and the sky is certainly not the limit when you're just putting your money into stock indexes and the rest of it. You know, even if that outperforms in some sort of statistical sense, I don't think you're going to do better.
You're referring to the compounding nature of real estate portfolio investments.
And growing that
with
financing.
Yeah.
Not just with your own. So the cash on cash return over time of buying properties with the bank's money.
Mm.
There's just not a lot of other ways you can do that. You can't buy NVIDIA stock with the bank's money.
No.
Unless you're in a different position.
Or insure it, for that matter.
Yeah. Unless you're in a different whole class of economic financial decision making than somebody like, you know, your average working person, which is, then go for it. You know, more power to you. But for the average person, I think real estate's great. And Japanese market, just to plug Ziv, is really interesting.
Yeah.
It's not the highest yield or anything, but it's really interesting.
This was not scripted, by the way. We did not expect this.
I'm a fan of it. I've been in a position to pull the trigger for like a couple of years, but I haven't done it. But I'm a big fan of it, conceptually.
You can combine the best of all worlds and get into Japanese REITs if you wanted to.
Yeah.
They'll give you the liquidity that the stock market gives you, but still let you focus on real estate sectors.
This is true.
And they're a lot cheaper to buy into as well.
Yeah. Safer too. I probably should have done that while I was waiting to do something else. But nonetheless, but the actual property market is interesting. For people, those few people who listen to you and don't know already, a lot of properties are really cheap. There's tiny apartments. There's old houses. There's things you can buy at rates that you can't even think about forget the U.S., but in most countries, even somewhere like Thailand, like you cannot buy a property in Thailand for $50,000 unless it's a condo that you don't really own, you know, in Pattaya or something. And it might be a very comfortable place to live, but as an investment, it's not going to do what it would do here.
Yeah. I think people, when we talk to people for the first time, like one of the first things we do when they describe their budget to us is, well, hang on, with that budget that you're talking to me about buying a house or a few units, you know, you can actually buy an entire multi-unit building for that 300,000 or 400,000 US, especially now with the yen where it is.
Right.
They're like, wait, what? It's not.
Right, exactly. So it's a really interesting market. It's really not for everyone, but if you like the country, if you live here, if you want to diversify with a very different asset class, talk to Ziv.
Thank you. Ziv's not taking any new customers on at the moment, but we can consult, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
We'll point you somewhere good.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Good to have you here again.
Sure.
And please, let's make this every year from here on.
So there you have it. Super insightful. As always, I really miss these conversations with Daniel. He's just such a never-ending fountain of wisdom on all things related to macroeconomics, isn't he? I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. And again, apologies in advance for the coming slow pace of publication in the coming month. I promise to be back with you mid-July, of course. And who knows, might be able to slip a few episodes in there even during this period. We'll see how we go. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa-related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com.
And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks, and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes Store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time, and until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku!